Welcome to Saha Says, where we go over headlines of the week, sharing our in-the-weeds opinions. Joining us tonight on the program, we have Vesh, a security engineer and Saha moderator, Pinky, the team captain for UTSA's CCDC team, and Cooper, a biohacker and our news curator, and myself, Sciatic Nerd, B-Side's SATX coordinator and manager of this podcast. And of course, we would like to open our program by thanking our sponsor, Axion VPN, who delivers a quality solution for your private connection needs. If you or your organization is interested in sponsoring the efforts of Saha or Saha Says, feel free to reach out to us using the hashtag SATXHackers on Twitter. Rolling right into the news, Coop is going to get us there. Why don't you start us off, big guy?
Yeah, we got an article here from torrentfreak.com. VPN provider PIA exits Russia after server seizures. Private internet access is informing users that some of its servers in Russia may have been seized by the authorities. The company believes that it may have been targeted due to its strict no logging policy, something which puts it at odds with data retention rules. And a digital world where surveillance and privacy invasions are becoming more commonplace, increasing numbers of users are improving their online security. As a result, in recent years, that has been an explosion in people deploying privacy-enhancing tools such as VPNs, which enable anyone to add an extra layer of protection against online snoops. One of the most successful companies in this field is London Trust Media, the makers of the popular Private Internet Access, or PIA, service. The company prides itself on its decision to security and is possibly the only operator to have its strict no-logging claims tested in public.
Now, that's really interesting. I'm sorry. I'm going to jump in. Forgive me. I'm just going to jump in and say it's really interesting to see that there is a push for a no-logging policy when, you know, sure, that's what you're paying for, right? I mean, Coop, you yourself, you use VPNs on a regular basis. And I'm curious if you would be concerned about the so-called perception of a police state. Do you think that logging is good or bad?
I would really not feel that a VPN is actually doing its job if they're logging what I do.
And how can you prove? How can you prove? Yeah,
otherwise, what are you doing it for?
Pinky,
or they want.
Oh, go ahead, Vesh.
Sorry. Well, they want the access logs. Who's going in, right? They can't. They're not going to be man in the middling you. But what they want is those access logs, which IPs and access the VPN, and who are they tied to? So that's what that's really what they want here. I don't think that getting in. They realize they can't get in the pipe. But what they can do is construct a case around who accessed what, when, and from where.
And now I'm curious if, Pinky, if you use a personal VPN or a paid hosting service.
We have a VPN set up at home that we set up, so I don't have the same concerns here about it. But, I mean, this is obviously the double-edged sword of you don't want your logs stored because you don't necessarily want people knowing, you know, what service provider you use, when you logged in, and from where, especially if you're doing whatever. But then there's the other side of, hey, I'm not able to log into my VPN and I'm paying for your service. Help troubleshoot. Sorry, we don't keep our logs.
Right.
So we can't even see your attempt, possibly. So
exactly. And I'm curious, Vesh, I mean, so I'm sure you have your own private setup, because we've mentioned it at the actual Saha meetings before that there are different ways you can set it up. Mauvehead has come down and talked about setting up stuff. Weeks has mentioned it a couple different ways. I'm sure you've got your own kind of rig, right?
Yeah, so I've got a couple of routers, and one of them has the OpenVPN, you know, OpenVPN service, and they access, you know, accounts that I have on various VPN providers. So if I really need something hardware that's infrastructure enforced, go on a segment of my network.
Sure.
If I go on a certain segment of my network, then it's on that VPN automatically.
Nice. And I have to admit that I have a small VPN, but it's just a connection. It's not a proper service. And I've actually been looking at Hack5 just 3 weeks ago. I have a two-part series on setting up OpenVPN at home, which I thought was fantastic. Mm-hmm. How to set up the server, how to set up the client. Now, it doesn't go into all the deep nitty-gritty of how to configure additional services that can hang off of that or use that tunnel, but it's a great place to start if you're trying to figure out how to set up your own virtual private networking configuration. So I think that's mm-hmm. pretty fantastic. And I was just wondering how expensive would you – what would you be willing to pay, right? I mean, what would you be willing to pay to let someone else handle this for you? And that's why it's so cool, like, when folks like Axion come along and sponsor the program so that we can let others know about setting up their own privacy. So that's kind of cool. Moving on then, I'm going to press and say, hey, Vesh, what are you talking about with this Ars Technica article?
So this is an article about multiple choice tests and whether or not that's the best way to gauge anybody in InfoSec. I say, of course they're on the bandwagon of, oh, it's a standardized test. It doesn't do anything. You're not showing your work. And my counter to that is, okay, we've got OSCP, and I'm just going to talk through the robot. I can't backtrack and all that. You got OSCP or whatever, and that's going to a lab, hack, pivot around a network. For the CISSP, like I have mine, they're testing you against a broad domain. And it's multiple choice tests. It's really impractical to push everybody through some type of formal, practical exam. So there's either you can use a service like TrueAbility and set up a series of tests and offload that cost, or you just say, listen, if you don't have this standardized test that we've determined it provides basic knowledge or basic functionality in our field, I don't really know what the alternative is. There are practical exams, but if I'm hiring a manager, a security manager who comes from like the IT field or something like that, I don't really care if he knows how to hack a computer or how to get in or write a buffer overflow. I just want him to have a knowledge of policies and domains. And I'm sorry, with the CISP, that's a multiple choice exam. It's like the bar exam.
Yeah, but NIST, it says in the article, is calling for a paradigm shift to focus more on skills and abilities and less on traditional credentials. So they're saying that employers must pledge to base their hiring on skills, not simply on certifications and degrees. But that's strange because, look, it's a way to weed out those who say, I have a skill set without actually being able to prove they have a skill set. Like you said, you go to a test. So an actual practical test, not a multiple choice test. But that doesn't help you if you're not going to build someone who is a targeted set of skills. You need a broad range of skills. You need a well-versed generalist who has the ability to learn on the fly. Is that not accurate?
I don't think certifications prove that point at all. It just proves that, just like the SAT has been criticized for the fact that it doesn't actually gauge, you know, intelligence. It gauges how much can you pick up the exam. There's always, you know, some sort of cheat. You buy the official study book, you just study it, you know, a week before, memorize it, forget it a week later, and bam, you're certified and you don't know jack shit.
Well, I do think that at some level, a lot of these tests, like the SAT, ACT, if you score sub 1,000, whatever the heck, when I took it, the baseline was 1,600, now it's like 2,400. But if you score below 1,000 or whatever the heck the thing is, you're probably dumb. You know, or you can't do it, or certain colleges are, like, you probably can't hack the basic coursework. Well, yeah, but that's not out of 2,400.
Well, yeah, they've changed the scale of the test. So
this was 1994 for reference. What I said on chat, yes, I got a 950 on my SAT. So
what?
Yeah, you're number one times two.
Okay.
Well, first off, All right. First off, I didn't know one. Well, secondly,
it's not what he's saying.
I'm just saying that not everybody that gets below 1,000 is an utter moron. Yes, on some things.
He's not saying that.
And I didn't say that. I said probably. You know, there are people who are legitimately bad test takers. This isn't for them, right? So there's alternative testing schemes. There's on the job type stuff. There's apprenticeship work where you can prove your mettle. What I'm saying is that for the 80% of the corpus, right? When I got to make a decision, I got a lot of people I got to filter out. A standardized test is not the worst thing on the planet to do it with. Now, if I'm trying to staff it with a specifically skilled individual, you bet your ass they're going to go through a technical interview and they're going to go through a practical and all that stuff. But there'll be a base set of requirements because, you know, I'm a busy guy too.
Right.
I've got to filter down what I'm doing. You know, I'm not saying that there's not the exceptional cases like you, Cooper, who's clearly an intelligent individual with a range with a high level capacity. I don't know why the hell you scored that low.
But look, there are truths to be faced here, and one of them is that not all people test equally, okay? There are such things as stage fright and a bunch of other factors that go into it. But the reality is I didn't score that well, but it doesn't matter in the long term. It does, as the people make it sound like getting a low SAT score is going to ruin your life. When in reality, there are a lot of other ways to make this work, but as a general indicator, that's the one that we've chosen to go with. And that doesn't mean it's the best choice. It's the choice that we have right now. And that can change over the years. Because, look, the test that was the standardized tests going on in grade schools and elementary schools has changed two or three times over the course of however old I am at this point. But I'm saying that, you know, in the 30 years that I've cared about what kind of school tests there are, you have to meet someone else's criteria all the time. It's always about meeting somebody's criteria somewhere to get something done. Coop, what's on your mind?
So speaking of tests just in general, not related to IT field and as a whole, you brought up schools. Well, my wife is an educator. I see the effect firsthand of teachers being pressured in order to have kids that pass, have kids that score well on tests, and I feel that's horrible because then you'll have teachers doing everything they can, almost spoon-feeding stuff so that the kids perform well, so that the administrators will get off their back, what have you, and the kids are lost in the effect. I can say in my own experience as a public school educated individual, maybe that's part of why my SATs were so low.
I'm also a public school. Come on now.
I'm just saying I can make the joke on that, but I can definitely say that there are some areas in small towns and where the funding isn't there, you know, compared to other areas, which we're losing our future based on teaching to tests. That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay.
I would put it to you that there's no correlation between how well a student is funded and how well a student does. What the Utah was the average pupil for educated in Utah costs between $3,000 and $7,000, and in Baltimore it's $17,000 per pupil. And in Detroit, it's, you know, what is $12,000-$13,000 per pupil, and those guys perform significantly worse than, like Utah schools, right? So there's no real correlation between funding and the success of a particular student. So, and that's per student spending. That's not anything else. So that's what money is actually spent on the student. So
to make it local, do you know where Texas rates among that as far as cash versus ranking?
Well, so there's different portions. So with Utah, right, you're dealing with a lot of schools that are very similar across a very similar demographic, right? So that's why when people bring up like a Utah school, they're traditionally saying that, okay, this is a large swath of schools that encompass a very similar demographics across the whole pretty much across the whole state, with a few exceptions. In Texas, the demographics between the inner city San Antonio schools are far, far different than the ones in Dallas, are far different than the ones on the outskirts of Fort Worth, are far different than the ones that are in my neighborhood. So the spending is decidedly different on each of those. Like my school, the cost per pupil is very low where I'm at, and the graduation rate is 98-99%. At the like Judson and other ISDs in San Antonio, for anybody who's had to pay San Antonio city taxes, the taxes for those schools are ridiculous. The graduation rates do not reflect the fact that there's 2-3 times the amount of money going in per student than out here, yet they have shittier graduation rates. So that's what I'm saying, is that there's lots of things that break the paradigm of how well a student, an individual student, is given money for their education versus what school performance.
Huh. See, now this is also very, very concerning from the point of view that we get into a lot of opinions here, and there's a lot of risk of us. This is not going to be solved, unfortunately, during the course of this program. I would love to see us actually put the emphasis on the right spot, but I still am not convinced we honestly know what the right spot is to fix whatever is broken, because there are still disconnects. And it's obvious. It's just that I don't think we honestly know always where to put our fingers on the pulse of the actual problem. And, mm-hmm. and it's a combination of things.
Well, I don't think the InfoSec testing thing is necessarily broken. I mean,
no, I think the InfoSec portion of the show is, when it comes to InfoSec testing, I think that there is a time and a place for certifications. Right. They have their place. They have a usefulness. And if it's something that, if you want work in that industry, in this sector, doing that kind of work, it can be used exactly, Coop. It can be used, thank you, in the chat room, as a baseline. There is a reality to saying, look, I am at least this far. If you're looking for this plus OSCP, I can demonstrate it. I've got the documentation ready to walk through the door. You don't have to add training to that. There isn't lead time to that. I have the documentation to demonstrate that I meet at least this criteria, which it happens. Pinky.
So my quick question to all of you three is, what do you feel about the combination of, or maybe the competition between a college degree, you know, computer science or whatever, versus having certifications or both? Because I know this is a hot topic in academia of, should students who, you can argue, may or may not be broke, should they compete for certifications? Is their degree going to be enough? Or does it give them some leverage, or is it useless?
I definitely have a point to start and to weigh in with, but Coop, go for it.
I can definitely say on just my own experience, because you're going to UTSA, I'm going to WGU online. A part of my degree plan and most of my exams are certification tests. So whether or not I do well on multiple choice tests, that doesn't matter anymore because I have to do it. Is it going to help me in the future? I'll have to say we'll see. The other two guys here, they probably have a better perspective on that. All I can say is, so far, it's been interesting just from my own point of view.
And I have to do you want to weigh in here, or do you want to go last, Fesh?
No, I can. I'm fine. So I graduated from WGU. I mean, now I'm going to Georgia Tech to do the master's. But yeah, my starting spot was WGU. It was cheap, and you know, it worked. So why not? And it was regionally accredited, so nobody could come back on me on it. But the NIST, and I love this when they ask a government organization. So NIST says, oh, we should be really flexible with our standards. And it's a standards organization. I don't understand it just goes to show you that you could ask a government organization for anything and you'll get two different answers depending on the day of the week.
Well, it depends on who is speaking to represent, because whether or not an actual individual represents the whole, there is definitely there's not always the same answer. I agree with you. I agree with that completely.
Yeah, but NIST will come back on you if you say, they'll say in this article, oh, there has to be a standard, or no, there doesn't have to be a standard. Meanwhile, they're lobbying Congress as a government body for a standard. I mean, this, I don't understand these. This is for them to offer any type of opinion is dumb.
So they're not offering an opinion or shouldn't be offering an opinion. They were actually directly asked and an inquiry was made, which it sounds like was pulled from a separate article to make this article. So,
yeah, well, they should just tell them we're a government organization. We don't know our ass from a hole in the ground. We only exist because the taxpayer funds us. So whatever we say, please be sure that, we're speaking out of both sides of our mouths.
That's awesome. Thank you. That's very, you know, team building. I love the way you build things. So I have to say that my actual bachelor's degree was not in computer related anything. And it took time to transition my background to what was more appropriate for this industry because people didn't used to want to pay me for the skills that I had. They felt, well, that's nice. Why don't you learn a skill that I'll pay you for? And so eventually that's kind of what had to happen. So multimedia production was not going places in this town, in this market. And so that was very challenging. And so people said, yeah, but you fix computers and you do computery things. Let's apply for jobs there. And suddenly I was picked up to do that kind of work. And the rest, as they say, is history.
History.
That literally was what got – that's what – you know, when someone said, I will pay you for that, but I don't want to do that. Guess what, kids? If you're Meg Ryan, go make a, unfortunately, better or worse, go make a rom-com. That's what America will pay you for. If you want to go off and show me a movie of something else, unfortunately, it turns out that that's not the career builder she was looking for. Because everybody wants to see her be cute and perky, and even though Tom Hanks has gone on record on television in interviews, she's not perky, people. She's not. That's what we want. And there is some truth to the fact that sometimes you have to recognize the frustrating reality that people will pay you for what they want to pay you for. If people see you as being in a certain role and they say, oh, you are awesome at that, I'm going to pay you for that, it's going to be a thing. And so, yeah, I admit it's a road. It's a road and a half because taking time to figure that out is part of life, at least in my opinion. So there it is. If you are currently in school and you are angling towards a cybersecurity or computer science degree, be prepared to look for jobs that line up with that, and having the bachelor's is a benefit. If you didn't actually finish that degree, if you didn't actually work through that issue, finish that out, and you're just going off to do the work, be prepared to run into potential roadblocks only because people are looking for the documentation to stand on. And that's, I think that's partially an HR concern, that HR folks say, okay, I'm looking for talent, or recruiters are looking for talent, and they are required, that's how they get paid, is to find the talented people. Well, if the guy next to you working his day or her day job at the local electronics shop, and says, oh my gosh, I've got all these skills. I do all this. When I leave this place, I go home and I start really getting into that thing I love doing. I love scripting or programming or whatever. That's great. But unless you can sneak around the HR channel and go straight to the hiring person, that's where the wall is. You have to scale that wall. You have to scale the HR wall and get an interview. If you can get the interview, you might be able to convince them that you are the right person for that job. But if you're stuck in a world of pre-scan where there's an automated system digging through resumes, how else are you going to do it? That you have to find a way through to talk to a human being. And that's the real scalable part, and I'll stop there.
One last comment on that would be, you know, degree, I think mainly that would say that above anything else, not that you're great at tests, not that anything, because in the end, the person that gets a D and the person that gets an A, they both are called graduates. It says you can actually finish something.
I agree with that statement. I very much agree with that statement because you at least finished it out.
And speaking of strategies to finish something, I think Pinky has something to share with us.
Yes, yeah, so if you're looking to get into cybersecurity, well, good news for you, if you're willing to sell your soul to the devil. I mean, the government.
Whoa, hey now.
The White House. I'm joking.
Trump,
the White
what?
House, yeah, Trump. If you want to sell your soul to Trump, then the White House has released The Federal Cybersecurity Workforce Strategy, and this is from FedScoop.com. So basically, if you've been paying attention the last few years, you'll notice that, especially under President Obama, that we've been trying to make a more of a cybersecurity push, get more of our, you know, more jobs in cybersecurity. So rather than going into all this, the main benefit from here is to acknowledge the fact that there's going to be more cybersecurity careers, so this is a good time to start trying to get a job in the government if that's what you want. And also, they're extending their one of the big scholarships they have, which is the Scholarship for Service, and they call it the CyberCorps Scholarship for Service. And this is going to be a way to fund at least one, if not 2 years, of your degree. And you get a stipend, you get your tuition paid, and life is pretty damn good.
So doesn't that actually scream dearth of available skilled workers? And I know plenty of people in this field who are clamoring for work, but there's must be some reason. Coop, what are you saying over there in the chat window? What's the issue that people might be having?
I do believe FBI reported, and we actually talked about that article a while back, that, you know, FBI has reported major issues recruiting people in Silicon Valley area to be just coders for the FBI, unfortunately, because of drug testing. Like, even people coming to an interview, which they knew they were going to be tested at, would smoke on the way.
My God.
So maybe there are challenges to finding – it's not that there's a lack of people doing the work. It's a lack of people who can pass the required strict guidelines, perhaps. What do you think, Vesh?
I think the government has too many damn jobs right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, it's a little bit pathetic because I see some of my coworkers over in the Air Force, and some of these people, like, no offense to them, Cooper is way better suited than they are. They're just grabbing anyone who's already in the field that has their clearance that, you know, isn't doing drugs. Whatever, you know, you're already in, so let's throw you there whether or not it's appropriate to your skills and your enjoyment in life. So it's kind of harming them because in the long run, they're still not going to understand that intuitive sense because they don't go home. They don't live it. They don't love it. They don't play with it all day long.
I'd like to use that phrase in the back of a T-shirt out of context, just saying. So there is a reality. There is definitely a need for those who are passionate about the career field itself. Vesh, you've proven time and again. Coop, you have proved time again that you have a love of this. And Pinky, I'm not trying to leave you out. I know I've seen you, I've spoken to you, and FreeBSD is hilarious. You guys are – that's part of what I really think bonds those of us at Saha is an actual enjoyment of this entire process, really. So that there is something to be said for having passion for your playing field. There has to be something that really gets you up and driving because I've met people who've literally said, man, there is money in that field. I want to get in that field. I want to make some of that money. And I'm thinking, what, some of that YouTube money? What kind of money do you think you're going to make? So let me ask you a real important question here, person who's looking to get into this field. Are you interested because there's money or because you love it? Because it's not easy work. This is going to be some soul sucking stuff if you don't enjoy it. And I mean, that's any job, I think. You know, you can do anything for a year. Isn't that the rough phrase? You can do anything for a year just to, and I think that's partly a pay your dues because when you get onto a team, there's usually a period, don't just go by me, talk to other people. But it seems like there's always a period of adjustment where folks are getting involved with things. And during that period of time, you're going to have to be the one who cleans up, the mess on aisle 7. You're going to have to do it. And after a while, you know, maybe you get away from that stuff. But there's got to be a place that you start. So I'm going to ask the terrible, what is the worst tech company job you've ever had? Vesh, let's start with you.
Worst tech company job?
Yeah.
You know, I haven't had a job that I truly abhorred. I mean, even when I always found a way to have fun with it. Like I was my first job was working at a grocery store. It was not technical or anything.
Oh.
You know, so what I did there was I made the most out of it by having fun. You know, I wanted to be on carts. Like I just wanted to return carts all day. But it turns out that they hired a bunch of sub-mongoloids to be able to do that.
Sub-mongoloids.
Well, I mean, literally, because they, these guys, they would pick these guys up because they are half part of their wage is paid by the state and part of their wage is paid by the company. So they really only had to pay these guys like a buck an hour out of pocket. So,
oh, wow.
You know, so I got moved to cashier, which I hated. And so what I did to get out of that was because they had a lot of difficulty hiring and I knew this, I would just fuck with people in the line. You know, if a person wanted paper bags, I'd be pissed off because they cut the shit on my arms. And I'd say, why? Why do you want paper bags? And if they told me a BS reason, I tell them, we're all out. And then, but then one lady was very smart and she goes, because I want the paper bags and I'm buying food. And I said, oh, yeah, that's completely valid. Like, I would make them explain the reasoning. And then eventually I was such an asshole that I got moved and took a job that I actually wanted. So
there you go, kids. So I could just
go back in the produce section and smoke weed and be happy.
Well, you know, that was actually cilantro. So just so you're aware, that's why you didn't feel those effects. It was actually
cilantro.
Yes.
That's what it was.
And
cilantro just had an awesome time at work.
There you go.
And we steal beer.
Oh, there you go. Terrific. So, you know, hey, everyone starts somewhere. And I'm curious, Coop, do you have a story in this realm or has it all been roses?
Well, as they, you know, might say, you know, pardon my French, but all shit does not smell like roses. And yes, I totally, first job in tech, a real job, was cleaning toilets.
Damn.
Until I corrected one of the senior techs that was working on a laptop saying, you don't want to do it that way. You're going to break the screen. And he just looked at me. He was like, no, I'm not. You don't know shit. And he broke the screen. And yeah, he got fired.
Wow.
I got somebody else got moved up and I got their job.
Nice.
And so they got to hire some other kid to clean toilets.
Got to start something, man.
Yeah. Hey, that's why, you know, I keep joking. It's like, hey, any InfoSec places need a janitor? I can totally Goodwill Hunting that shit.
Well, yeah, but if you start sweeping it up and you do your, you pay your dues, man, yeah, there's no reason why not. Sorry, you were saying, Vesh?
Yeah, lots of them need a theoretical janitor. So
that's good.
A lot of bullshit.
Is that a reverse engineer or what?
No, he's saying there's a lot of bullshit.
No. You won't find too many capable reverse engineers that engage in the Adam Reeve level of bullshit. That's the Pokemon Go idiot.
Oh, man.
Way to check your work, Adam Reeve.
So
Dan Guido checked the work. Why didn't you?
See, and that's the way we have to be careful now, people.
Yeah.
So now
one's a blogger, the other one's a capable reverse engineer. That's what happened.
Oh, ouch. So here, let me switch back to the, I gotta switch back to the right page. Apparently having too many tabs open can damage your ability to see where you're going. Who knew?
I believe we are moving into the EU US Privacy Shield Agreement.
You are correct, sir. So apparently, The Verge, this story comes to us from The Verge, and if I can get scrolling to work on this machine, there we go. The European Commission has formally adopted a new agreement governing the transfer of data between Europe and the United States. More than 8 months after the long-standing Safe Harbor transfer deal was invalidated amid concerns over U.S. surveillance, the new agreement, known as the EU-U.S. Privacy Shield, places safeguards on how U.S. authorities can access the data of European consumers and creates a framework for resolving cases where Europeans feel that their personal data has been misused. The Data Transfer Pact goes into effect today, and U.S. companies will be able to certify their compliance as of August 1st. And just to clarify, this article was from the 12th of July. So it's already in effect, folks. So now, Vesh, I know you are always knee deep in the political fray here. Is there anything going on regarding this that you would like to talk about first before we get opinions? Or you know what? Maybe some feedback from the rest of us.
Okay. So a group of communists and a group of fascists got together and they hammered out an agreement that's going to be good for us, right?
In a bar?
I mean, yeah. So the Justice Department and the EU communists decided to have an agreement. So you know it's going to be designed with the citizenry in mind. I mean, this is gonna fuck you 8 ways from Sunday. We just don't know it yet. Don't know. It's not. It hasn't been there. And tech companies saying, well, we welcome the new deal because if we say that we didn't, we're absolutely going to be trounced. And you'll see that the people that they said, oh, tech companies are raving about it. Yes, the tech companies that have a gigantic legal arm and have joined together in large umbrella nonprofits to make sure that they're covered under the agreement. Yes.
Well, right, because under the agreement, in the article, it says, under the agreement, U.S. companies will have to self-certify that they meet higher data protection standards, and the U.S. Department of Commerce will be charged with conducting regular reviews to ensure compliance. Okay, that's a giant audit function. So, hey, we were just talking about how do you get a job. If you can prove that you want to do audit work, there is a pile of it about to be showing up through the Commerce Department.
Self-certify, but we're going to audit you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, an arbitrary set of standards, and I'm going to self-certify, and then you're going to come and audit me. This is bullshit. No way. That's like telling the FBI, giving the FBI full access to my computer, and saying, "Well, I'm certified that I'm FBI ready," and then them going through and being, "Okay, well, let me just see a couple things. Oh, it looks like You know, it looks like you might have mischarged somebody here, and that person is in another state, so that's a cross state line, so that's a felony, and that's us. Yeah, I can see this going all kinds of different ways.
Oh. So I'm very curious to see how this builds. And Coop, Pinky, what are your thoughts?
Self-certifying just sounds like a terrible idea. I'm sorry, I'm losing words here because it's like I can't believe that anybody would say, you know, we're going to hold you up to the standard and you have to self-certify it, instead of, no, we're going to create a nonprofit organization that handles certifying you, auditing you, what have you, to ensure that, yes, you're upholding your certification. Otherwise, we're going to yank it out from underneath you because you suck.
Well, okay, Pinky.
Yeah, we're self-certified that we can do absolutely everything, and when in reality we can do nothing, and we'll wait for the audit, which will take forever and a day with everyone trying to, you know, do this, just to find out, and in the meantime, we possibly did everything we wanted, which may not be legal at all, you know, it's great.
Well, and you know what, so apparently you're not alone in these thoughts, guys. The quote here near the end of the article says, sadly for both privacy and for business, this agreement helps nobody at all. And this comes from the exec director of the European Digital Rights group, or yeah, I guess it's EDRI. It's an association of civil and human rights organizations. And in their statement that was released on Tuesday, they said, we now have to wait until the court again rules that the deal is illegal, and then maybe the EU and US can negotiate a credible arrangement that actually respects the law, engenders trust, and protects our fundamental rights. Now, I think that as much as it matters what I think, it's amazing how, you know what, we're going to just barrel into this again, and then when it falls apart, we'll actually try to get it back together. I mean, basically, that's what I'm hearing from everybody here, is that this is not going to work. Because in the way I'm hearing it from the article, it's like saying, I'm raising my hand, I'm ready to be inspected, I'm claiming I'm ready to uphold what's in this document, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to. That's what self-certifying is, right? You're basically saying, I'm ready. I'm claiming that I'm ready to do business this way. And then now
and
I'm opening the door.
Not only that, I am giving you carte blanche to open my books at any time. That's what they're really doing. I mean, who the hell's going to
And no one's going to
sign
do
that. Up for that?
No, there's going to be two sets of books. Isn't that the joke? If you go back, look far enough, there are two sets of books. And that's the risk.
Major.
Right. So very, very interesting, that's going to be nation state changing. But then that's EU. So wait, and thanks to Brexit, that's a different group of people in some cases.
Oh, too soon.
Oh, sorry.
Well, that's Britain was the only one we wanted to talk to over there anyways.
That's a different kind of wallflower.
Why don't we just put the Greeks on it? You know, I hear they can run the books really well.
No.
Yeah, exactly. Well, wait a minute. Give them props, because they can run the world's largest scam organization and still get people to give them money. And then claim, look, Greece is too big to fail. And I'm sitting here kind of looking around. I'm like, aren't there U.S. companies that have a higher, you know, GDP than Greece? I don't think Greece has been productive since, I don't know, you know, maybe the Greek Empire there.
Ouch.
You know, that might have been the last time that there was any type of actual, you know, production out of Greece. It's pretty much just been, fat greasy mafia, wannabe mafioso since then.
Wow. That's a real positive outlook you have there. I'm sure you have friends across the globe. So speaking of friends, why don't you tell us about other friends? You know, like the one in the tossing out cell phone stingray evidence.
This is an article from Reuters, and it's – so the U.S. judge tossed out stingray evidence, and the synopsis is you cannot – you're using the cell phone to track people. That is a tracking device, and you have to have a warrant. Just because you call it something different doesn't mean the principle changes. It's a tracking device.
Yeah.
So now if they were to go to his Twitter feed – and take positional data off of that. He's posting that to the public. It's not protected. He's aware that people are going to find him. But the cell phone, you know, they're assuming that you're not revealing your location by using a cell phone. There's no presumption of that. So it's not public information. These guys need a warrant. And this whatever his name is. But this guy is a capital douchebag. This in the vein of Rudy Giuliani.
Wow.
He's one of those gung-ho. Yeah, I said it, Giuliani. And don't think I don't know that when you were mayor of New York, you bought all those people bus tickets and sent them to screw up my neighborhood.
Oh, damn.
So, yeah, that's how you clean up crime in New York. You put a little bit of pressure on the local populace, and then you take every piece of trash and give them a bus ticket to upstate New York. Thanks, Rudy.
So,
ruined my town.
I was going to say, so I'm guessing you were not a Giuliani fan. Okay.
Well, over some type of socialist or communist, yeah, fine. I'll take a law and order, whatever, over a communist any day. But I don't like Rudy Giuliani. But the stingray was this pre-Bahara guy. He's one of those. He's the insider trading guy. This guy is such a fan of wiretapping and skirting civil liberties. He has built his case like that. Okay, he's prosecuting a large insider trading thing right now, and a whole slew of wiretaps on financial sector guys. And now, of course, Wall Street guys are scumbags. So. Apparently, every single one. So, and insider trading is such a well-written law, not nebulous at all. Especially when, you know, Hillary Clinton can get away with insider trading, but Martha Stewart has to go to jail.
But when Martha Stewart went to jail, we got new towels.
Then we'll, oh.
So what would we get if Clinton went to jail? More emails stolen?
I don't know.
I have no idea. I just, you know, we're past that. We're past that. You know, this FBI said that she did nothing wrong. We're past that.
Interesting.
The attorney general who was propositioned at an airport by her husband, isn't going to press charges. But we're past that. We're past that. The crux of the matter is that, Mr. You need to get a warrant for things that require a warrant.
Well, they said absent a warrant, you cannot use it for tracking, which I thought was interesting. I was not expecting that. I kind of figured they would say, well, you know, I've watched enough Law & Order SVU to know that you can track people by using a cell phone. And instead, they're saying that critics of technology, in other words, Stingray, or the cell site simulator mimic cell phone towers, basically femtocell theft or spoofing, whatever you want to call it, forcing pings to get transmitted back to the devices so they can find people. They're saying that, you know, you shouldn't be able to use those tools, but that's not the same thing as using it as a tracking device, but they're claiming that it can be used that way. One ping only, Vasily, and that's it. And they know where you are.
So remember people, this only works, that Stingray only works on GSM equipment. So if you're trying for LTE, and UMTS, that Stingray stuff doesn't work. They try to knock you down and get you on the GSM network. That's what they do, because that's the only GSM is the only protocol that is still implemented where there's not some type of mutual authentication, tower to phone, phone to tower. So turn off GSM.
There you are. You heard it here first. Well, no, not first, but you heard it here. You heard something here.
You probably heard it here. You did probably hear it here first because nobody really knows that.
It's good knowledge, actually. And I'm very curious then. Okay, so all right. So Sprint doesn't use that at all. So how are you going to use? How are you going to get a Sprint network to pick it up?
Well, Easy Sprint doesn't work in the first place.
Oh hell!
Yeah, exactly.
Especially in San Antonio.
Are you saying we're not going to get them as a sponsor now?
Oh,
Sprint. Well, they've thrown money at dumber things. I mean, you know, let's not take it out of the cards yet. So
if you sponsor us, we'll say nice things about you.
There you go. We're willing to be paid off.
Not,
that's
not exactly. And remember, it's not what your SIM card supports. It's what the radio on your handset supports.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. So, just because if your handset supports you, there's a good chance that even if your provider doesn't have it, they're still going to implement it, right? They're still going to say, we don't have GSM towers. However, oh, shit. Am I frozen?
Yeah, you're back. You're back. It was bad for a little while. You're all right. Well, I pinged the internet, okay. The giant book of knowledge, consulted the book of knowledge, and it says that Sprint and Verizon phones now have SIM cards, but not because of, it isn't because of CDMA. It's generally there for world phone support. So it's possible that they could get forced into it because I've seen plenty of cell phones, get knocked from their main tower, and by readdressing, it appears that they are announcing their location. Because they have to announce to a tower. So I was just surprised to hear that it was dependent on a particular, that Stingray was dependent on a particular technology.
Yeah, because otherwise it wouldn't reveal, your phone isn't going to reveal any information.
Because of mutual loss.
That's why.
So, okay. That's actually really interesting.
Right. So, but your roaming, but to support like roaming agreements in different areas and stuff like that, I bet you even if your provider doesn't have GSM, they still, are able to leverage the GSM protocol within your baseband. So that's what it is. But they've got to first, knock you off of whatever LTE tower you're on, jam your signal, whatever they're doing. So,
well, AirCrack NG and tools like that can force off Wi-Fi. There must be an equivalent over the cell protocol. Yeah.
Yeah, there is, and but mostly it's like selective band jamming, things like that.
Okay, it's still the same end result. Is it's forcing you off the network to force you to request to gain access to announce, essentially, right?
Right. To say there's nothing. Hey, there's nothing available at 3G and above. Why don't you just go on this GSM tower that is conveniently close by and very powerful?
And in the back of this van. It's in the back of this van, and it's on the side. It says free Pokeballs. So,
hey, where's this van?
Screw you, I'll be back. And screw you, Preet Bharara, rah, 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 rah. You're a douche. I hope they bring you up on contempt after this.
I don't think you're going to get your wish there, buddy.
Got it.
Well, at least it's something to keep in mind and discuss anyway. I wanted to actually talk about something related to privacy, or at least if not privacy itself, it actually pokes at more of our digital privacy. So the Tor project reboots with a new board. So apparently in San Francisco, the Tor project, according to the NewYorkTimes.com, the Tor Project, a nonprofit digital privacy group, on Wednesday replaced its board with a new slate of directors as part of a larger shakeup after allegations of sexual misconduct by a prominent employee. Well, isn't that just a thing? Now, if you were anywhere on the internet and you know some of this community, there was a massive outcry against this individual from the Tor group, who apparently is alleged to have done quite a few things that are not popular. How about that? I'll say that are really not nice things. Because all the other words that come to mind are not family friendly, and it's just I think I'll just go with Vesh's. Maybe this person's closer just to, forgive me, the person's a douche nozzle. According to the way that everyone's been talking about it, a complete and total douche nozzle, and it's, oh gosh. And so anyway, the point is that Tor is coming back and saying, look, we've made a change. They've been plagued by controversy, and most recently involving allegations of sexual misconduct. Okay, look. They forced him to step down, and now they're saying they've appointed a new executive director, and they want to restructure the group and make a comeback. But does anyone care about Tor anymore? Is Tor even still relevant? Pinky, would you even be willing to use Tor at this point?
I have never used Tor. I haven't been interested, but I know a few members of my team still use Tor. They're still going to use it. There's probably the possibility for it to come back in popularity, but personally, I'm not interested.
The days are past us, Coop. So what do you use, aside from Axion VPN? Are there other tools? You look like you're digging for something over there. I think there's a prop involved with whatever you're about to say.
Well, I do happen to have a small little black box around here somewhere for Tor, but have I powered it on? No. Have I taken it apart? Yes, to make fun of it.
Uh-huh.
Am I going to ever power it on? Not in my house, but maybe your house. Can I borrow your link?
No.
Then we can take a look at Tor together.
Oh, dear.
No, Tor's on fire. Let it burn. Throw it away. Get something new, something better. I don't want to route all my traffic through the FBI servers. No, thank you.
You were about to say, Vesh? I don't
want my traffic either. It might be boring.
I was going to acknowledge that it was Team Grime Time that won that Anonymous box, I believe. InfoSec Southwest. Whoop, whoop.
That's right.
Yep.
Be there next Southwest. Year. Yeah, there. We will be there. And we're going to get there.
And yeah, Cooper. Oh, God, yeah. Cooper really went all out on the tattoos and everything.
Yeah, Cooper actually got team tattoos going on there for Team Grime Time. Amazing.
Yeah, I got plenty of room left for next year, so let's get first place again.
Well, nice. we got to make sure that somebody stays sober, because a couple folks tried to get tattoos last year and they were too drunk and the tattoo artist turned them away. So that's why we won.
Yeah, that's why I stayed sober.
Yeah, you know who you are, Mr. or potentially Mrs., but let's face it, Mr. got too drunk to get a tattoo and thus lost.
Oh, gosh.
You know who you are. Let's say his name or her name.
Or their let's face name. It, it's him. Well, we could be. You never know.
We just need a rooster. Not cackling
la la.
So for me, Tor still has its usage, and theoretically it's still a very good thing to use. There's lots of folks that still use the Tor network. If anything, they use it for that first hop to get them out to their actual infrastructure that they want to use to obscure that initial entry, right? So that's what Tor was good for.
You just gave me that strange thought that actually that it's just a song. It's Tor, huh? What is it good for? And the answer is not absolutely nothing. It's actually the first hop. That's what the answer.
Yeah, it's good for obscuring your first hop. And I wasn't surprised that when you had, like, if you drew the Venn diagram and one side was a government guy and then the other side was a member of a nonprofit board, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's that high levels of narcissism and sexual misconduct wouldn't necessarily follow.
Oh, I was like, wow. No, go ahead.
And I'm just like, there have been several nonprofit boards and wherever, and anybody given a high level authority there, that are narcissists and think they can get away with murder because they're open to the community. And then, the government folks that think just going to power through it. And then the government folks that think that they are, they're top of the world. So, you lay those two over one another. That's it. You know, you're going to end up with, this guy. This guy should be the prototype. This guy should be, oh, you come from both those worlds. We're worried that this might happen.
So I want to move away from the concern about the board of directors, and I want to instead talk about more fun things like the hacks of the week. Now, this week, topping out our section is an article that comes to us from HelpNet Security talking about hacking smartphones using voice commands hidden within YouTube videos. So I think that's kind of fun. So this comes from a group of researchers from Georgetown University and UC Berkeley, and they've demonstrated how voice commands hidden within YouTube videos can be used by malicious attackers to compromise smartphones. And for in order for it to work, this attack, the targeted smartphone has to have Siri or Google Now turned on, right? And it's got to be listening for the right keywords, those activating words. And those, if the video in question is not played on those devices, they'll have to be close enough to hear the actual commands, and then they would be in trouble, and they would start executing the commands that are embedded in the videos. Now, I know plenty of podcasts I've listened to that have trigger words in them that kick off the whole, oh, okay, whoops, my phone just stopped doing what it was supposed to be doing, and now it's doing this or that, or the device that was listening, because I thought it was neat all the time, the idea that I'm getting closer and closer to having that a live little computer system in my home that I would be able to talk to, since I can't actually have the Tron life I really want. The closest I'm going to get is Hello Computer, and there we go. So I think there does need to be a different kind of interface out there some point. But for the moment, this is the coolest one I've seen is our voice respondent systems. Because look, one of the most amazing talks I had seen was B-Sides LV from Kismai Anthea. I think it was 2011. And he was showing off how to use a cell phone to kick off scripts that he had waiting on servers, distant servers. So he'd call up a number and he would use an IVR system basically to kick off the scripts. So here he is. He's not saying a word. He's just dialing on an old crappy cell phone. I mean, a crappy burner phone. And he'd just dial up, enter the keys, drop the power from the device, shred the card, and it was gone. And so even tracking where it started would be a real challenge. It was interesting. And just to think that we now have people just using videos, I'm guessing, of Pokemon Go, a how-to video. And then suddenly, someone else's phone is calling an international number, and that's it. I don't know. What's the harm in having this video call out live voice commands? Pinky, what could you possibly come up with? I'm baiting the hook here.
Well, there's the obvious of, with phones just taunting the phone, making them call stupid shit, Make it so every time they call Siri or Google or whatever, calls, and it's like, hey, Siri, and they'll be like, yes, dipshits, or whatever. I mean, there's obvious ways of that. There's, hey, give me passwords if we'll do you that. I mean, there's the obvious little stuff. I mean, I personally am not going to go hack that many. Okay, I probably would hack smartphones on my CCDC team. I'll get it. I would.
See? Useful stuff. Coop, what would you do?
I think it'd be fun to have like some sort of voice command that would make any SSH keys saved on the phones be emailed to me or sent up to some sort of cloud share.
Man, I'm having trouble getting Siri to like dial up the right number. How are you going to get Siri to go that far?
Just an idea that would be fun.
Oh, okay.
Not something that I know how to do.
Teach me, senpai.
No, I'm not that good. Otherwise, I wouldn't be saying, hi, can you hire me to clean your toilets? That would be fun.
Fun toilets. Toilets are fun. Look at the blue water. Vesh.
Don't eat the big mints.
So these guys are, it's a bunch of French guys with a radio rig and everything. Mm-hmm. When is the last time, why would you let a group of Frenchmen with full backpacks near you? Like I have discomfort with one Frenchman being within 3 feet of me, let alone an entire crew with a radio rig. I mean, because they said that okay, we can achieve distances of up to 16 feet, but practically you have to have the microphone plugged in and blah, blah. And that's because the microphone is more sensitive, than the phone microphone. So how many people do that? And they even said in the paper, although they don't say it in any of the other friggin' news articles, I wonder why, that the attack is actually unwieldy.
It's not efficient. Yeah, it's right up.
It was like the RSA saying that they can get AES keys off of improperly shielded cell phones. But then they had this rig, and it was one gigantic antenna that was aimed 3 feet away from the phone. And they're like, "See, with this, we could snoop AES keys." And I was like, "Oh yeah, nobody's gonna find that one."
Yeah. If you're using something that can pick up that range, that broad range from all the way down to 300 going up to what was it, 2900 megahertz and higher, going up into the cell phone bands. Yeah. Number one, that antenna is, the cost alone is prohibitive to a device that's capable of pulling that. Number two, it's going to be freakishly obvious that you're trying something that you shouldn't be trying, that would stand out like a sore thumb. So it's not practical.
If you do want to control something with a phone, you can use things like Twilio, or you can use, I've said this a couple times, I've had several presentations, you can use an old Nokia 3300, 3900, and the F bus on the back, and then use Nokia and send your commands through that. You know, automated, you can send in SMSs and items like that. So if you didn't want to use Twilio or one of those other providers, you'd rather pay for it yourself, go buy a burner SIM, go buy a burner Nokia, you know, create the pad like I outlined on my blog there. You're going to have to look for it. And then just, you know, have an access point into your home infrastructure over IP. And
you can do
cell phone texts and all that stuff over an IP network if you so chose yourself.
I think that's actually really cool. I think that would actually be a fun IoT project, personally.
Yeah, put it on the stack.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. Because, you know, I happen to have like 200 of those, and that Raspberry Pi cookbook isn't opening itself. So lots of fun ideas, though. So meanwhile...
Yep.
All of this aside, I was wondering if you might be so kind as to talk to us. Sorry, actually, this one is Pinky's turn. Excuse me.
Yeah, so, you know, the HackerNews.com, our favorite website, has announced on Tuesday that, you know, there's a new bug on Windows, big surprise. But this one allows the principal bug to allow you to hack any version of Microsoft's Windows, apparently. And this flaw is as simple as, you know, allows an attacker to install malware remotely on the victim machine that can be used to view, modify, or delete data, or create new accounts with full user rights. That was posted on MS16087 bulletin. And there's just a lot of different things about this whole bulletin. It included a few others, but mainly it's the fact that, you know, if they can get to your printer, which would be, of course, behind the firewall, then you can, you know, easily go out to other devices in the network without having to worry about that. There's man-in-the-middle possibilities. It's just yet another time of, you know, do your firewalls right, have your ports closed, you know, patch your goddamn operating systems, and, you know, the usual.
So I've seen at least two presentations on the dangers of leaving printers set to default because they become launching off points. Because once upon a time, going back to the days of the i960, I think is what it was, 950 or 960, the little chip that was in the board that would drive, large multifunction devices, they were not necessarily that dangerous. It was an embedded OS, but it was more proprietary. These days, everything seems to be running an embedded non-Windows operating system, for goodness sakes. So everything becomes a freaking foothold situation. All of these devices, if not locked down, if they're not doing mutual auth, if they're not doing certificate-based logon, all of these things represent massive security risks. And here is a way to take advantage of all of them. Standing out in the open. That just disappointing. But at least it's been announced, it's being patched, it's being closed. Patch your stuff. I mean, really.
Well, or you could just do what Script Junkie does and turn off Print Spooler, and then only turn it on when you need it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
But that's more you know, that, most that's people a, don't even know, man. They don't even know you can do that or would want to know how to do that.
Yeah, you can do that. All right, for the people listening out there that aren't already versed in this stuff, just go to services and stop Print Spooler, and then turn it back on when you need it.
Yeah. It's true. So that's a way to protect yourself. That's fantastic. That's top tip for the day right there. as opposed to the Rudy Giuliani comments. Pinky, do you leave Prince Spooler active?
I don't use Windows.
No, okay. I didn't ask if you used Windows. I asked if you leave Prince Spooler active. Because Cups is a print spooling system.
No, I remove Cups. Oh. Cups causes grief.
Oh, that's right. You're Cups on Arch. You're on Arch. That's right. You live on Arch. You live in
Arch. Imagine there's been some serious bugs in Cups.
Oh, man.
And not as of late, but there have been some big ones.
And Coop, how do you print these days? Are you just using rocks and a bag of leaves? What you doing?
I plug it in when I need it, and when I don't, I think hard copy you. Unplug it, throw it in the closet, get it out of my sight.
Well, there you
don't
go.
Like hard copy in any shape or form.
Well, you have to print out something sometime. Maybe.
That's what toilet paper's for.
Wait, you print on toilet paper? Is that what you're using those old adding machines for? I don't. Thank you. Thank womp you womp. Very much. Womp, womp, womp. Now, you shouldn't be making that noise. Go see a doctor immediately. That actually closes out our hacks of the week and moves us on into the gadget prong. And we actually start off with Coop talking to us about Apple Tech.
Unfortunately, yes. So, let me pull up the right article, if I can.
We're all hitting at the same
compute.
Time. It's the most hits this website has had all day. I don't know. I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah. So we've got the antimedia.org here. And it's saying here, in light of most recent police murders caught on smartphones and in one horrific live stream, it seems that there is a caveat to our fears of ambiguous surveillance. It's not just citizens who are overseen, it's everyone, including police officers who use excessive force. Recording police is widely viewed as a way to keep cops accountable for an ethical and kind of
panopticon
for the people. I didn't know the word. However, a recent patent by Apple has information rights activists worried the government is looking for ways to control our mobile devices. A recent post by the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, openly speculates that government and law enforcement agencies may try to use an infrared emitter to turn off phones when citizens film police abuses.
Okay, I got to stop you right there. When I was a kid, more of a kid, there was a toy called Captain Power, and you could basically take this toy and point it at your television, and they would embed these signals in the graphics in the video that the toys would respond to. And so this sounds like, you know, it's no different. In a way, it's basically watching for the signals from that. So it basically, okay, so make sure to recharge your vest so that it turns off nearby cell phones. This also presupposes that we're going to use a wireless piece of tech that actually stops something for a change. When was the last time you saw a piece of wireless tech that suppressed activity like this? Vesh, I'm sure you have got to be thinking this is a great idea, right?
Well, you mean aside from the entire purpose of electronic warfare, which is basically jamming? I mean, yeah, this is just software supported DW. I mean, yeah. For this, I like that they have Apple, and this goes into the talk we had earlier. So the geniuses at Apple and geniuses at NBC have both pushed out patents that virtually assure nobody else is going to use technology that the government wants widespread.
Right.
So it's NBC locked up piracy analysis. Apple's locked up remote phone camera shutdown, so they're only going to be supported by NBC and Apple, and which last I checked is not the entirety of the world.
You don't think that other companies aren't going to come in here? Forgive me. You think that other companies aren't going to come in and pay them their nickels so that they can go and use the service?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Why would I as a phone manufacturer? I'm going to have because now I have to have a camera to support it, right? Yeah. I have to have something to read those signals that has to be on, and I need to. So this is just all this is going to do is the people who buy Apple devices because they like Apple devices, like me, And I like my iPhone, and I like my iPhone for the physical dimensions and, you know, the battery life. And, you know, yes, it does just work. I'm sorry. And but for other people, you know, they're gonna still buy Androids, and that's it. So it's just a damn. I just like the fact that this is something that the patent system can do for us. It can take shit ideas and lock them into only one company.
Wow.
That has shit hardware? What?
Well, I just can't, like, what? What kind of hardware?
Shit hardware.
Oh, shit hardware.
Apple.
Oh, yeah, but
so close. It's locked away.
Hey, I'm not an Apple fanboy, but I like a phone that doesn't feel like it's a million degrees in my pocket after 6 months of use. And that has been every single Android device I have come in touch with. And I have come in touch with not on the order of like JDuck or somebody, but when we were doing cell phone systems and all these different testing rigs and different surveys, I had a lot of Android devices. And let me tell you something, every one of them got hot and every one of them ran the battery down way quicker than any of the iDevices.
Now we're talking about the reality that, there may be better design in some devices than others. I'm not saying one way or the other, but I have to admit, the phone doesn't get hot unless it's under a lot of use. So what's it doing? Meanwhile, there is actually, thinking back to that NBC Universal patent that you were talking about earlier in the program, there is a reality that they could use that to help maybe detect, and I'm wondering if we want to really get our tinfoil hats out, if they wouldn't use it to deter or deflect or to make poorer the response times for swarm-based streaming services, because it looks like we're on the rise. Because I was just listening the other day that a daily tech news show, that there is a service about to launch from BitTorrent as a news service. So it would be a way of actually streaming live material or hosting material to stream as a TV replacement. So I'm very curious to know if they would stop at the edge, if NBC Universal wouldn't use that patent to actually somehow target that service and I don't know, do something bad to it, you know? Because that go ahead.
You mean a corporate studio system supported only by copyright and IP perversions would use a technology to shut out competition? That was sanctioned by the government. I don't see that ever happening.
Well, Pinky, do you subscribe to this theory? What do you think?
I already have all the same thoughts. I already said I'm not going to beat this dead horse anymore. I'm sorry.
Coop?
I'll plead the fifth on of opinion on this one. I'll actually step aside.
Wow, I can't believe it. We actually all seem to have similar thoughts on that one. And
once and the only time.
It may very well be.
Repent now, sinner. The end is near.
Agreed.
Well, you know what's actually much closer is setting up a Raspberry Pi 3 cluster. And Vesh, maybe you could tell us about it.
So it's from medium.com, and this fellow, he goes by the moniker Boss Jones, and he spent a lot of time setting up a Docker to deploy images and functionality to a Raspberry Pi. And the reason why I took the story was because in this mix was the Jenkins continuous integration server, which is BSD, or is it licensed? And I got to tell you that it is a great piece of software. You know, this continuous integration server, and I'm glad to see that a lot of these deployment tests and everything have been done on that backbone, and that's what kind of looks like that's what Docker is using at some level for building, testing, and then deployment. There's a ton of shit you can do with Jenkins. I'm good. That's what I'm using to host the code snippets for the class that eventually I'm going to finish. Still on slate track for Q1 delivery, but it's a great, great service. And this guy is setting up a Raspberry Pi cluster, you know, Really, it's kind of whoop-de-doo, but the fact is he has a lot of the steps there, which is great. Like, this is a tutorial. This isn't a news article. This is a tutorial, and he's got everything he needs, like all the command dumps and everything like that. So regardless of what you want to use it for, it's a good tutorial to follow. I wanted to talk about Jenkins, and this was using that, so I shoehorned that in.
Actually, this is pretty amazing if you look through the steps that they're describing. If you look through the actual work you have to do, it actually, you aren't kidding. This is a full one and done, run and gun, get it going. This is yep. really nice. And even if you don't do the whole thing and you don't want to set up your own cluster, there are great single steps you could pull right out of this. Sorry, Vesh, go.
Oh, yeah. And the 29, yeah, and the coupe, that's right. That's not lost. I mean, that this took 29 minutes. You know, I mean, I'm sure that from start to finish, it took him 29 minutes, but gathering all this together probably took a few days. I don't know, maybe he timed it afterwards, or maybe this did take him 29 minutes. I don't know, but, yeah, it's each individual thing is there. And, on the Jenkins end, why would you set up a Raspberry Pi cluster? For me, going back to Jenkins has the concept of slave nodes that do the builds for you. So if I can just do this, set up a series of slave nodes, deploy the Jenkins architecture, which is basically just a jar file, I could use this.
Okay, can I plead stupid here? Can I get you to stop for a second and go back and explain what Jenkins is? I'm admitting that I'm like, okay, usually I don't feel quite this out of touch, but right now I'm currently saying, all right, I need a – I'm calling phone a friend here.
Yeah, Jenkins is a continuous integration server, which basically you and it can pull from GitHub and all sorts of different repos. So if it sees an update to GitHub or whatever, or you tell it to run a project, it will pull that code in and build it for you with parameters you provide and tell you whether or not the thing built and run any tests you want to against it.
Oh, wow.
And then you'll have a ready-made binary that you can download. Wow. And test again and run. So,
and so it just periodically reruns to check your latest build of the code?
Yeah, well, if you task it, it'll run. Or if it just sees new codes on the repo and you've pointed it to a specific branch, it'll pull that down as soon as it sees the commit.
Wow.
Great way for production.
So, yep. And that way you don't have to have somebody building and everything. It'll run those basic tests for you and all that. So, it's a great service to provide. And the fact that it can set up slave nodes that do the compilation work on different areas and then just talk the results between them and do all the downloading to that one central location, that's great too.
Dang, this is awesome. And this is just using a Raspberry Pi setup. Man, that's cool.
For me, I use a cloud service and QMU images like emulation when I want to build ARM and MIPS. But in this case, the guy could create a series of slave nodes off of this Docker. Like, Docker had already been deployed, but if he really wanted to do a build service, he could do it off of that Raspberry Pi cluster just by deploying an extra package and rigging it up to the build server. So that's what I would kind of use this for.
And, Pinky, would you build toys like this, or is this not something that you're into?
No, this would totally be fun. I just don't have the extra Raspberry Pis at the moment. I have, you know, one for the VPN and one for a black hole. But, you know, next time I get some around, I might do this for a little bit next time I'm going through a coding spree or, you know, following someone's GitHub. But right now I'm a little bit overwhelmed with other tasks. So this is, you know, in the long list of things to play with.
And unfortunately, it looks like they're out of stock in most places. Raspberry Pi 3 should be available in more places. But gosh darn it, it's still... Why is it still so hard to find you, Raspberry Pi 3? Why?
Same with Raspberry Pi Zero.
Hey, I got my first. I got my $9 computers in. So my chips.
Oh, you finally
got
your
like
chip.
It?
I'm still waiting for mine.
I haven't. I haven't pulled it up yet. I think I'm gonna have to buy the shield and all that. I gotta buy a wireless keyboard. Nice. Though it does come with RGA, but. Or RG, whatever the connectors are, the three connectors there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I got to see what I'm going to do. I think I'm just going to, it's going to be Christmas presents for kids.
Oh, yeah.
Combine it with, Yeah, yeah. But wireless keyboard, combine it with a you know, a small-ish monitor, and then, you know, just put a package around or something. I'm gonna figure something out, and then here's your Christmas gift. It's effectively a computer / TV.
Oh my gosh! Wait, the Raspberry Pi 3 is currently in stock at Element 14. Just saying.
Buying one now?
I'm actually considering it because they say they've got 5,100. No, they've got 51,000 in stock. I don't buy all of them.
Is there a limit per person?
It shows 1X. If I try to put it in 3, what would happen? Cut card, shoot owner. I think that's bad. I'm not sure. Hang on.
Maybe you and two other friends could buy one at the same time.
Maybe.
I don't know. Why not just buy Odroids? They've got a better NIC. They've got more USB 3 ports. They got a better processor in them.
I hadn't heard of this.
Odroid. Yeah, the Odroid.
Also a lot more expensive though, too, right?
They're only
they are.
You could get one for maybe like $30 or $40 more than Raspberry Pi 3.
$30 or $40
for a nicer one more, but
dollars more.
Yeah, but you know, like. Our VPN is struggling at the moment because the Raspberry Pi just doesn't have enough, you know, bandwidth on this network card to support what we need, you know, and we're limiting our speed at home. So we're looking at an Odroid down the road to replace it.
Yeah, but the Odroid.
It's not just the NIC on the Pi.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
It's the what?
It's the cryptographic. Yeah, but they don't. I don't think they update. Do they still make Minnow boards?
Yes.
Oh, they do. Okay. Oh, I thought the Minnow went away.
Minnow
board was there at Texas Linux Fest last weekend, and also PFSense or a PFSense dealer from Austin was there, and they were also selling Minnow boards as well.
Wow, I thought they would be gone. And back in the day of the Beagle boards, because BeagleBone Black, which was great at the time, I haven't heard of a new release of that. And now
still great.
They're still over $100, but they're not bad.
No, they're very good. And so it looks like this. Actually, there's an octa-core Linux machine, the Odroid XU4. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, but that's actually a $74 monster. Look at that thing. That is amazing. It has gigabit and not yet, wait till after. If I have any money after hacker DEFCON. Summer camp, I mean yes,
DEFCON
DEFCON and B-Sides LV, if I have any money left after just going out to learn and work, then perhaps I will consider looking at these toys. But see, I'm always trolling Craigslist to see if anybody sells any of these cool toys. You have to look for strange search terms just to see if anyone has anything. Cause you gotta figure someone runs out or needs to go and do other things. Well, no, can't find anything. Anyway, so, let's see.
So, if I could get back for a second on the Raspberry Pi 2 thing or even 3 is, coworker, and this is a coworker of mine. I didn't find this cause I didn't run the test either. The cryptographic functions required for a VPN connection, especially using like 4096 or 2048 bit keys, was the Pi cannot handle it.
Oh, no.
Shit, you're kidding.
Yeah, so it's not just the NIC, although the NIC is too. It's the cryptographic functions aren't being handled
on the Pi. So if the cryptographic functions are lackluster on the Pi, That's a disappointment.
FreeBSD actually corrected me while we were talking. Apparently part of it's just the USB 2 bus speed as well. You know, everything around is just too, it's so inexpensive that everything's just too slow partially. Depending on its use, what you want it for, if you just want a cluster play with coding, or, you know, even just play on one, it's fine. Or a black hole, you know, again, it's fine. It's just what do you want to do with it, and that's probably something we all need to start thinking of now that there's more solutions than just buying, ooh, shiny.
Well, but shiny.
Yeah, I mean, the Odroid has better shielding, too. I mean, I don't find, I believe that the build quality is a little bit better on the Odroid. And plus, they publish their open specifications, too. So if you want to take their hardware and make your own board, you certainly can.
And the version 4 here looks, I mean, pretty mighty. Even though it needs the little tiny fan on top of that heatsink, they didn't waste an ounce of space on this thing. That is a beautiful little piece of design.
Yeah, I got one sitting right here.
Yeah. And yeah,
the droid's so pretty.
And so, what are you doing with it?
Yes.
What does it do?
Right now, it's sitting in a hardware box. Yeah, right now, it's sitting in my box of things I had to clear out because, you know,
reasons,
legal proceedings.
So I was very curious to know if it runs. So does it have to run Android? I mean, Odroid's just a name, right? I mean, it's a full.
That runs Ubuntu.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, I could just put asterisk on it. I could put asterisk on it, and it would be fine.
So you're saying it's still good enough that it can run bloatware according to FreeBSD?
What? Oh, good gravy!
It is
according to FreeBSD.
Bloatware.
And when we say FreeBSD, according to FreeBSD, we're talking about FreeBSD is hilarious, not the actual organization FreeBSD.
Yeah.
Pinky's FreeBSD, not everyone else's FreeBSD.
But FreeBSD is free for everybody. No, wait, that's sorry. Sarvesh,
for the right price, FreeBSD could be for everyone.
Oh, dear Lord.
This is so awkward.
What was the next article?
To segue back into the show.
Well, actually, I do believe that it is Pinky's turn.
Yes, it is. So I'm going to see how long I can keep this article open because it's from TheWire.com and they don't like them running my black hole.
Mm.
So Chrysler launches Detroit's first bug bounty for hackers. Mm. So I guess they're being inspired from, you know, the recent, you know, the Hack the Pentagon events and whatnot. And instead now what they're doing is they'll pay you the low money value of $1,500 US if you find a bug and their cars. That way they're not an embarrassment at DEF CON or Black Hat and all those again.
So, that $1,500, would you do that work, Coop?
I think it sounds like bug bounty food stamps, really.
Ouch. Do you feel the same
compared
way, Pinky?
Compared to, say, Google or whatever.
Yeah, they mentioned Google will pay up to, like, $10,000 for Chrome bugs. So, I mean, it really is not much in comparison.
Didn't JDuck get like $50,000 for an stage fright?
I do believe he made significant money, but that was over several separate vulnerability reportings or incidents, I thought. Vesh, am I off on that?
Well, I don't know. No comment. I've never asked them about it or anything. I know that bug had many different facets. And,
yeah, that's what, you know, I was getting other, at. Not the finance, you know, but that there were several different parts to it.
Yeah, yeah. A couple other hands in the pot there. And, and there was some leverage there to move over, which is what, like, all people, I believe, should, you know, maybe do this. Like, this was a good way to take advantage of a little bit of spotlight and a good bug. You know, rotate that into doing your own thing or a better deal with say Zimperium or wherever wherever he went to from AccuVent. So no real comment on the bugs, technicality, specifics or any payouts. I just know from observation that he made a really good go out of it. So that's good. And that's what we should all do. Something similar, if you feel that you have something that is unique, you know, either uniquely yours or whatever, is go ahead and don't expect anybody to pay out on that bug bounty. But if you've got something, work it in, figure out some other way to make it work for you.
And Pinky, would you ever do bug bounty?
Legal way,
yes. And Pinky, would you ever consider, number one, in reading through this article, did you ever think that this is something you would do in your spare time, is just quest after bug bounties in general, or do you see more interest in focusing on building things? Where do you find your focus regarding bug bounties?
One, I'm not sure of what this free time thing you're talking about is. I've heard it exists. I have not experienced it personally. Maybe after I finish my PhD, I'll discover what it is. So I'll let you know. So apparently, my interests right now are suffering through a PhD program, suffering through a PhD program, and when possible, suffer through CCDC.
Got it.
But it does interest me. Do I have the patience for it? I don't know. That would be my limitation there. It sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. I think when I actually got into it, I would lose my patience. As simple as that.
And by the way, this requires that you have a Chrysler, and of it making of you make Chrysler very slim.
Well, I mean, if you have a Chrysler figure out where the holes are, you know, I'm sure that they would be interested in hearing about it in a legal way.
Yeah, well, last I checked, the only people who owned Chrysler were rappers in those big 300s and 80-year-old men.
He does have a point. I have a Jeeps. Toyota.
Well, aren't Jeeps on the line? Yeah.
Because Daimler.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And fraternity guys who are on the beach night.
So there's no better way to start a job.
Get your bro up.
So GM, have you heard that GM is actually going to use a power glove? Are we going to see a comeback maybe from the 80s? I'm not sure. But according to this article from Wired, imagine the impression you'll make wearing a robo glove, a power assisted gauntlet General Motors wants to give to its factory workers. It may look like something in a Power Ranger costume, but it's inspired by a real life space robot. So NASA and GM built Robonaut 2 for tasks too dangerous or demeaning for humans on the internet. National Space Station. So the super creepy humanoid was strong enough to lift 40 pounds and dexterous enough to tap out text on an iPhone. GM is now working with Swedish medtech company BioServo to adapt the Robonaut's grip to gloves. So pressure sensors and actuators mimic nerves and muscles so it knows when the hand inside is picking something up. And it's gentle enough to handle eggs and yet still firm enough to maintain a strong grip on something so you're not wasting energy holding a hammer, for example. It's a pretty amazing concept this is one step closer to that really awesome load lifter from Aliens. That's what I think. I'm not sure what your thoughts are. Vesh, go.
So, don't worry, UAW. You will still make absurd amounts of money, and it will still require the same amount of labor, even though the labor is easier, because that's what's due to you in your contract, in spite of everything contrary to that. It's more the ability to accomplish more work with less is a good goal, and using a power glove or a power glove-like. Interface is a very smart move because it provides all of that nice tactile advantages that we get out of a hand. But like I said, the real move here is they're going to have this science. It's going to sit on a shelf because there's going to be a bunch of UAW pricks that are going to sit there saying, no. If we use that, then there's going to be less of us on the line. Because that's the point.
Just wait till the robot union shows up. Pinky, I'm wondering if you think this would actually be of value in other industries, or do you think it's just going to be useful for the auto workers?
I mean, this is going to be useful for probably anything that has assembly in a production plant. Because they mentioned in the article this power glove is gentle enough to handle eggs even. So with that, it probably can be gentle enough to handle more fragile parts. It's just... is it going to pick up? Is it going to be affordable? Are people going to see the, use for it? That's harder to say. Again, maybe security, you could argue. Why not?
And Coop, do you think this would come in handy in work with firefighting and other things like that? Would people be able to use it as a life-saving device?
I would think so, but I also kind of want to go back to the article from Japanese auto workers getting a full exoskeleton. If they could combine that instead of just stopping with a glove, it would definitely be great for, rope rescue, firefighting, what have you, as long as it's heat tolerant. It definitely would make it a whole lot easier to carry out, people while you're, trying to not die in the fire yourself.
Always good to not die in the fire. And I think that, maybe this is a step towards, life-saving automatons, right? Send in the robots, go bash down the door, not worry about if it's gonna catch fire because it was designed to resist it. And so I now use a camera and, it's not gonna be that, the telepresence system where you see it undocks itself like a giant Roomba, has a TV set up top and you can see the picture of the person. Somehow I just don't see that, With thermal imaging. I think that it would have to be a little bit different or a little better. And actually, unless we have more to add to that story, that actually closes out our section on that today, moving us into the App Attic instead. And the first thing up is a Trend Micro CTF. Isn't that right, Coop? Actually, I'm doing that wrong. Isn't that right, Pinky?
Yeah, I don't know what's with you lately. I mean, last podcast, this one, you know, let's pick on Pinky here, but okay.
I know I'll pay all for seriousness. It. Sorry.
Nah, it's all good. And I don't know about you guys, but nothing makes me more excited at times than seeing a new CTF.
Woot!
And I personally haven't heard of the Trend Micro CTF. If they've done this a previous year, I don't know. But the online qualifier is going to be at the end of this month, actually, the 30th and 31st. And it's going to, the only qualifications is that you have to be 20 years old or older. Hmm. And if you're one of the top 10 teams from the qualifier, you'll automatically qualify for the final hosted in Tokyo in November.
Oh, wow.
And challenges are going to include, you know, the typical Jeopardy style, you know, with the traditional ones, along with what they're calling in addition to binary and packet and targeted attack. There's also going to be the Internet of Things and SCADA this year.
Oh, wow.
And then if you make it to the Nationals, you know, it's going to be attack and defense rather than Jeopardy style. And the winner is going to receive 1 billion Japanese yen, or 1 million, my bad.
Okay.
Wow. I don't know my zero.
Whew. Oh, goodness.
1 billion would have been awesome.
1 billion yen.
Yeah.
But how many yen to a dollar?
It's going to depend on November, isn't it?
Yes, it does.
They also it's not British to pounds.
Considering the current way that the two chief currencies are going, I would say I'd want that million to be factored up just a bit. So,
yeah.
But this is kind of an interesting place because for those that don't know the genesis, and if you think that this CTF is something that is new, different, or like I wonder if they're going to do it well because they haven't done CTFs before. They're going to do it well, and here's why, is because they bought from HP Tipping Point, right, which is ZDI, okay? And we know a lot of people on the ZDI side of Sears. So now they're all Trend Micro employees, and that's who basically set this up as I read it. So these are guys that ran Pwn to Own, and now because they can't have Pwn to Own – because there's some dispute there as to who actually owns this thing, I believe.
Wow.
Last I checked, some under the covers nonsense. They're going to do the CTF instead, I think.
Oh.
I don't know if it's an instead or if it's what, but ZDI had a, it looks like ZDI had a hand in this, and ZDI had a big hand in Pwn to Own. So now we've got this instead because Pwn to Own is not being executed.
I didn't realize that Pwn to Own was going away, so to speak. But I guess if the whole team got acquired, then there would be a question as to whether or not it would still be taking place. And for the record, according to a monetary conversion chart at the moment, this is just, you know, a projection. It's not actual value. 1 million yen at this moment is worth roughly about just shy of $9,500. So, in case you were wondering what it would translate to, so you can win just shy of $9,500 for winning this CTF. So, get your work goggles on and get to it. And if you're at Shinjuku Station, there are plenty of things to do and see in that area. That is an awesome part of Japan.
Isn't it mostly anime stuff now?
Nah, not necessarily.
How is that not awesome?
Well, okay, I mean, look, I'm not arguing the giant robots and, you know, aren't awesome. It's more the maid cafes I have a concern with.
Well, you know, I'm pretty sure this is where that virtual reality porn festival is supposed to be held. So maybe if you're lucky, they'll, you know, have to reschedule for this time frame.
No. Actually, in the news, 2 days ago, a penguin park opened in Shinjuku. So let's look at the penguin park instead of the other potential.
Maid cafes are.
Yeah. See, the top 10 things to do in Shinjuku, according to TripAdvisor, does not include whatever was said separately.
Porn.
What? They're talking about going to look at nice stores and going to look at the Samurai Museum, which is also in Shinjuku. So these are good things to go and look at. Or how about the Goyen National Gardens? Or I know I've mispronounced that, but that's better to do. 'Cause, you know, at least you wouldn't be virtually drained. I don't know. Trend Micro. I put my foot in that. Well, whatever your fetish, it's your problem. Look, Trend Micro CTF.
Yourself.
It's a what? Anyhow, nothing.
Anyhow, kudos to you, Trend Micro, for digging out the ZDI team and putting something together. Kudos to you, and I mean that. That's not sarcastic.
So awesome stuff. I would also like to bring up at this point that Engadget, actually, if you're not a huge Tor fan, and maybe you were looking for an alternative, so MIT, according to Engadget, actually is bringing up their own anonymity network. So they're saying it promises to be more secure than Tor. So as crucial as Tor's anonymity network can be for keeping your online activity private, it is not flawless. A motivated hacker can compromise legions of users, whether they're crooks or privacy-minded innocents. Researchers from MIT and EPFL might have a better way. They've developed an anonymity network called Riffle that promises to maintain privacy so long as at least one server is still safe. Now, they said the secret is the use of a mixnet, and they go through a bunch of detail about how this methodology is better. But the point is that the technique is extremely efficient to the point where transferring takes a tenth of the time that it would on a conventional anonymity network, which is important as these nodes are frequently end-user computers. So anything that helps you not bog down your system, that's to your benefit. Anyway, I'm very, very interested in seeing where this goes, not just because they're showing a person with a bag on their head in front of a computer. but there has to be a better way to do this stuff. And if we can use these, the Odroid devices as our endpoints and actually build really cool tools that help us keep ourselves private on the network when we want to be private, I think it's worthwhile exploring. And it's, I think, funny that in the same show where people are basically saying, yeah, Tor, I'm not so sure it has its uses, but here's a more efficient implementation of a concept that's being done. And I don't know what EPFL is, but I wonder if this is going to be a public thing, if it's free, if it's going to be a pay-for service. I'm not sure. I'm curious, Pinky, which, if you heard of this newer system, or if there is another an anonymity network that you've tried.
I personally haven't tried any of them yet. That's mainly due to a lack of time and reason to. You know, I'm happy enough just using, you know, Signal when necessary for talking to friends or using, you know, privacy settings on your internet browser, whatever. But I think this is a really good opportunity just from a business why, you know, Tor hasn't really caught on per se, and they're going through, like we talked earlier in the show, they don't have the best reputation at the moment. So this is a great time for other solutions to try to pop up and become, you know, obtain that popularity that Tor never got.
Oh, good point. And by the way, I looked it up. EPFL is actually, I believe, the Polytechnic Institute, basically in Switzerland. Is that right? Where CERN
Lausanne,
is, right?
Lausanne or something.
Lausanne?
I don't know how to pronounce it.
I can't pronounce it either, I'll admit it. But they speak French, apparently, and English, so that's nice. However, the point is that they actually have a Center for Innovation, which looks like that they are developing a drone that gets around obstacles. So they are in this space, is the point. So they're very high-tech minded, and so they are collaborating with the folks from MIT to build a more secure network. That's interesting, I thought. What do you think, Coop?
Definitely like the idea of more tools coming out. I'm just totally not sure if I would actually be interested in using it yet. I just got to wait and see how well it works.
And how about you, Vesh?
I get worried because in order to do this verifiable mixing that they talk about, they have to retain a copy of the map. And that just sends off of you know, red flags to me. And the other item is that MIT isn't separated from the government by any big thing. You know, there's several contracts and people that roll right in there. It's one of the NSA's biggest places where they pull mathematicians and computer scientists stuff from. Why should I trust them any more than some kid in his basement? So, and with that verifiable mixing, you need to retain a copy of the message on the originating server. And, you know, that's, to me, spells disaster.
The first time someone can actually pull out one of those retained copies, huh? But isn't that the whole point of encryption, is that they're not going to have the keys? Or is it search and seizure, then they can take it and they would have access to it? Because once you have physical access, all bets are off.
Well, it's just metadata, right?
Theoretically.
I mean, that's it's just metadata. So it's just the time a message came in, from whom it came, from whom it went to, and to where it's going, and provides the ordering and shortness enough to where maybe it's a weak cryptographic algorithm or something that's against there. I don't know. But the fact that they retain a copy, they have to maintain a copy on the server to do the verification, just that, to me, that seems – no, that's doom. And they should know that. They should know better. There's a reason why the public key stuff was working. There's a reason why we were doing that. And I don't care that it was expensive. It was right. It's only expensive because we got a bunch of asshat CAs that charge too much for the shit.
Mm-hmm. I think that moving – we're starting to move in the right direction with Let's Encrypt and services like it.
Yeah.
We just need to get more and better. And we need people to understand. And we need people to build better tools. But that's another show. And instead, I'm going to ask if Coop – now I think I've got it right. Coop, if you want to talk to us about open source tool checks.
Yeah, from helpnetsecurity.com, we've got an article here about security researcher Philip O'Keefe has created a tool that allows users to check whether they have reused a password on multiple accounts.
Oh.
Now, the individual behind the motivation behind creation of Shard, which is the name of the tool, as O'Keefe dubbed the command line utility, was recently a massive leak of LinkedIn passwords. He knew that he had reused the same password on many accounts, but couldn't remember the exact ones, he explained to the author. He has switched to using a password manager and likely unique passwords for every online account, but judged that others could use the tool he created, so he published its source on GitHub. You know, the modules currently offered with Shard can test one or multiple sets of login credentials on Facebook, LinkedIn, Reddit, Twitter, and Instagram. O'Keefe offered instructions on how to create new modules for other sites as well. So what do you guys think about this type of tool?
So I will go ahead.
No, you go.
I will admit that I already have a tool like this in use as part of my password management system. I use LastPass, and they have a checker that watches and safeguards against it, or at least it warns you. If it says, hey, I've detected you're using this password on more than one site, you should fix that. And it actually will run a checker against the database you build in their vault to actually check and see where you are. And they have a privacy guideline set, and they actually will run the self-test and help you get more secure if you actually are interested in doing so. And I think this is great because not everyone wants to pay for LastPass, and this is available in just out there on GitHub, and every little bit helps. I think it's a good idea. Pinky, you were about to say.
This doesn't have any of the same functionality as LastPass. I'm looking through the GitHub code. You know what this is? The guy has a bunch of URLs. And then he just submits username and passwords against them. I don't understand the complexity. There's nothing. This is not complex. This is not a.
No, it isn't actually.
No, it's it is basically a. I bet you that there are 50 bajillion scammers out there, or black hats that have the same exact script and have had it for years. They just didn't think that it would be usable by anybody else. And this guy says, "Hey, you want to check if you got the password? Same passwords." We're going to pile it in here. It's not impressive. It is the first time I've ever seen anybody really commit to Scala, but or Scala, however you pronounce that language. But
Scala, yeah. Wow.
You're right. They do use it. And God, I mean, I've used it before and it runs like crap on, you know, home equipment. It runs a lot better on server. And, you know, Scala works a lot better when you run it continuously. Then it can outperform Java. But for like a simple Hello World, it took forever to run in comparison.
Well, dang.
Oh, see, there you go. A guy writes a password scanning tool, and he gets media coverage, and he wrote it in a language that we that is not used and universally abhorred, on a firm technical standpoint.
And it only uses 11 different websites it compares to. And when you look at it, you have to give the password out on the command line. So you're having to do this by yourself. You know, you're typing in your username. You're typing in your password. So it's not like it's a module that plugs into whatever you're using and then it does it for you and it scans all of it. No, it's, you know, let me test it, which defeats the purpose because I'm lazy. I'll just save my passwords or use the same one. And now you're asking me to take time out of my day to do this. No, I'm still not going to.
And it doesn't warn you if it's trying to submit a password over. There's nothing in here that I see where if it's trying to submit it to an HTTP and not HTTPS login page, it doesn't warn you and say, hey, dumbass, you're about to pass a clear text password over an unencrypted channel. It doesn't even do that. So for those of you that want a real solution, go install, and you don't want it to be one password or last password or whatever, go install Thycotic locally like I do, and then just use that and use the randomize feature whenever you need to build a password. It's plugs directly into my Chrome browser. I click the button. It brings me up a little screen. I got a login page, and it says, oh, you don't have any creds for this. Do you want to add some? I say yes, and then I put it together, and then I can hit one button, and it logs in automatically for me.
Wow.
Is it only available for Chrome, or is it available for all browsers?
It's a bit of JavaScript, so it should. If you don't have the Chrome plugin for Thycotic or use it for Firefox or anything, there is a shortcut like a bookmark that you can make that they tell you they give you, and it'll just run that. So unless a website implements CSP, and then you can't inject into that web page if they do that. But I haven't found too many pages that actually do that.
So I'm going to keep us in the same theme here by talking for a minute about a Lifehacker article that talks about comparison shopping for password managers. So this article actually says you have a ton of options for password managers, but when it comes to your security, you want the best possible tool for the job. And they take a look at some of the most popular password managers and compare them side by side. This is the one that I'm going to suggest, folks. If you're actually listening to this program, please go take a look at this article for the Lifehacker Face-Off, the best password managers compared. And I think this is going to be a really good one. I've got a nice chart in here that talks about everything from the method of password generation and how it saves. And it's good. So it's a very interesting story, and I'm hoping that people might take a minute to read through it. I'm a fan of LastPass, but you know that. 1Password's also very good. There are tons of good tools. I'm going to cut that off there and jump instead and ask Vesh about how much he enjoys playing Pokemon Go.
I like it, and I've written several LinkedIn updates and whatnot, a lot of shitty comments about people and participating in FUD and reposting that crap post from Adam Reeve. Don't give out his blog or his URL. Just please, for the love of Pete, don't hire somebody who'd commit to this amount of stupidity and trying to spoil everybody's good time. So, yeah, I do play Pokemon Go. I think it's entertaining, and I haven't had the same level of issues that other people have. You know, they're like, oh, you know, there are people been hit by cars. There have been people, which is like a lot of this article from smh.com.au. I have no idea. That's the website. They're saying, oh, there's a big problem with Pokemon Go because people were walking off of cliffs, sand dunes, whatever. Listen, from time immemorial, there have been stupid.
Sorry, it started to launch a video when I clicked on it. Go ahead.
I haven't seen, you know, Al Franken submitted a letter saying, I want to know the dangers of this, you know, the
Al Franken. Oh my gosh.
The authentication or whatever the hell it is, you know, because if, you know, if anybody deserves an answer, it's Al Franken. You know, Canada, can you please relieve the United States of Minnesota? Just come and take it. We won't fight you. And but for like Pokemon Go, I've been walking down the street, and I've talked to people I would never talk to. I've met people I probably would never engage with, and you wanted the definition of a disruptive product. This is it. You know, it's not every little thing that they go at TechCrunch or whatever the hell it is. You know, they say, oh, this is disrupting the marketplace. This is disruptive. This has changed people's behavior.
Yep.
In mass, on a large scale, and caused them to adopt something that has been brewing for a while. So this is what disruptive is. For every single person, when I hear a stupid startup pitch and they like, I want to know why it's disruptive, right? Okay, Pokemon Go is disruptive. It's like Facebook, but is not.
Yeah.
So this is what
Pokemon Go started basically, as far as I can tell, it is a Pokemon skinned version of Niantic's, what was it? Ingress. So Ingress was the actual game, which was Google's big claim to fame 3 years ago. And so it was an awesome idea that has been played by quite a few people. But when they put it, and they put the Pokemon skin on it, it's a game changer. And I'm sure is slightly different. It's not just that, but.
Part of the problem with the original one is that they only had the game out for Android for a few years, so it caught on, got some popularity. But they didn't have the iPhone one from launch as well. So, you know, it had its little bit of popularity. It didn't have some sort of catch, you know, it's just, let's go outside for fun and, you know, do this random thing. So it didn't have some sort of nostalgia or whatever tied to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they released the iPhone and it caught on a little bit. And they're like, well, no one's playing anymore. None of my friends are playing. Whatever. This had the benefit that you have the two biggest mobile operating systems ready at launch. And then you're tying it into what some people grew up with, what some people are still growing up with. So you're capturing a good demographic of basically people in their mid-20s, maybe early 30s, and before all have grown up with this.
Yeah.
Are still growing up with this. So you have a huge marketplace, and then you have the adults, or not that 20 and 30 year olds aren't adults, but you know, the older who have gotten used to it from their kids as well.
And I mean, so I admit I have not played yet, but I have plenty of friends who do. And I think it's awesome that it's something that gets us up off the couch and actually talking to each other and interacting. So I have to say that there's a lot of room to grow here. And the fact I'm hoping that it's more popular. It stays popular, rather, for more than a couple of weeks. Coop, what do you think?
I find it hilarious that I could never get my wife to actually play Ingress with me. But now she's like, why don't you play that game again? And then I'll play Pokemon Go and we can like go do the same things.
Aww.
I thought it was kind of silly to me. But, you know, as I am kind of well-fed, you might say, it might be good to do such things.
Good. So, you know, and look at that. So, Pokemon Go, helping families get along. Look, if it works and it works for people, hey, why not? That's a good thing. And so I'm going to say, all right, so with that, I'm going to move us to the last story and say, hey, Coop, why don't you talk to us about encryption gaining adoption in the enterprise?
All right, we've got an eWeek.com article here saying a phenomenon survey reports that encryption use by companies jumped 7% to 41%, the largest increase in the 11-year history of the report. For a long time, encryption was like drinking pure juice or taking castor oil for employees in an enterprise. Mm. They only used it when they absolutely had to. Not so much anymore. And enterprise for data storage and email security is now almost mainstream with enterprise, largely because internal and cybersecurity issues are at an all-time high. And security companies have been working hard to make encryption and key management easier to use.
That's what you're saying, people. Get your certs in order. Sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, it just makes me say, What do you think? Does this make you say jump up and down and screaming, hell yeah, finally, please God, let it keep continuing?
Yes, actually, almost exactly that. I personally have been dying to see this technology move out of its infancy, which it felt like for years it's ready to do, but people are not ready to adopt it. They just, okay, that'll be great when there are some tools. But it seems like no one is writing the tools to really bring this to a level of ease of use, right? That's what's really missing. The technology is here. The mathematics support it, mostly. We won't go into that part at the moment, but if we can get people actually using these things and it became as ubiquitous as an understanding how to use a car key or a swipe, a mag stripe on the back of a card, I think people would do it. It has to be like that. It has to be that easy. It has to be 4 seconds or less. It has to be near flawless. Well, guess what? Nothing's near flawless, right? Pinky, you've used technology all your life. You seem to be a strong proponent of it. Can you name any technology that doesn't have its flaws? Come on.
Nope. And when you find someone that will, they'll be rich. You know, if you can make something that's flawless without a problem, you'll be the most rich person out there probably.
And isn't that one of the huge things that CCDC actually works to engender in folks is to get the idea that these things that you must learn, that you must learn to implement, and you have a time limit on it. Isn't that one of the key elements from NCCDC is how quickly you can set up your equipment? I mean, come on.
Yeah, it really is. And it's also to have you stop thinking, you know, in such a conventional line of thinking, if you do steps 1, 2, and 3, and then it's secure. It's making you realize that you can do steps 1 through 5,000, and they're still going to be the next day, like today with the Microsoft bulletin. Bam, it's insecure. You never thought about this, did you? So it's just that weird out-of-the-box thinking that we always keep proposing, and maybe we could tie this back to earlier in the program with standardized testing and schooling and all that. You can keep, you know, testing for it, and we just, it's hard to teach out-of-the-box thinking without hands-on learning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Coop, I love that you posted the key takeaways in the chat window. Would you do me a favor and read that second bullet, please?
Yeah. It looks like performance and latency are now considered most critical features of encryption applications, reflecting increased encryption adoption and the need to assure IT managers it does not interfere with business operations.
And see, that is so
keyword. It does not interfere with business operations.
Because it's so critical that things don't get to slow down because, oh wait, it's like you've ever been on a family outing or something and you want to take a family photo. Everyone get together in front of the giant ball of yarn or whatever. And okay, squish in together. Okay. Now I'm going to take your picture. 3, 2. Oh wait. Wait for the flash. Oh, wait. No, something's wrong. Oh, wait. No, that's it. You've ruined it. It's over. Nobody cares anymore. If you can get folks together, quickly snap that picture and move on, nobody's going to complain. But the second you start asking folks to wait while someone figures out an issue, it might as well be useless from the perspective mm-hmm. of the people involved. And the same holds true, whether it's support for both cloud and on-premise deployment, ascendant to the most second important feature of encryption applications, whether it's database communication securely, actually having your database protect the information as it moves in and out of a database, whether it's setting up more secure systems like HSMs, hardware security modules, all of these things are expensive things. Talking about cloud protection, getting companies to embrace these security procedures and the technologies, it's changing the way, or will require a change in the way that we work together and how we build our infrastructure. Don't you agree, Pinky and Coop?
Yes.
Agreed completely. And, you know, I yearn for the day where we can see this percentage, you know, rather than be 41%, which, don't get me wrong, this is a great percentage. But I can't wait for the day we see this in the 80s and 90s%. And end users, like, you know, our stereotypical parents who can't turn on a computer without help, you know, the day they can just use encryption, they don't have to think about it, and life's great. Are we ever going to get there? Maybe not. But well, it's a nice dream.
It's a nice dream. And actually, I'm going to jump up and down for joy because we've reached 41%. Maybe we're another 10 years out. Maybe it's another 15. But that number is going to grow. And mm-hmm. it becomes more ubiquitous, I think, as we grow up. people who started out knowing this and that's the way the world works, they don't think twice about this, I would think, comparatively. Now, folks who maybe, you know, get off my lawn attitude about the security stuff, oh, it's never going to work, fine. There are always going to be detractors. But if we can take baby steps and move forward with our Manischewitz jar full of fish, that's a What About Bob reference, then, you know, we can at least take baby steps and work towards a better goal. And with that, I'm going to say thank you so much for listening to us trample through the weeds, the tulips, and all of the other shrubs in the way. Bring me a shrubbery, I dare you. No, thank you so much for listening to us, and please feel free to reach out with questions or comments. Please find us on Twitter at SATXHackers, and maybe next week we'll actually talk about just security. Thank you so much for listening.